The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We start with some signs of Ukrainian forces gaining ground and pushing back Russian forces. Intelligence reports say Ukraine has retaken ground west of Kiev and destroyed a ship in Russian-held territory. When Russia launched its invasion a month ago, it expected to take Ukraine in a lightning offensive. Against all odds, Ukrainian forces continue to keep one of the world's biggest armies at bay.
Would that military help guarantee any peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine, or do you not take those peace talks seriously?
I've got to tell you that I'm not optimistic. Vladimir Putin really wants that. I think he's decided to double down.
I don't think the nuclear option really is in play right now. I'm more worried about the chemical option because chemical nerve gas, that has been used. It's in their DNA. Putin has used that against his political opponents. Look what he did to Navalny. He's used it in support of the Syrians. And remember back in 2012 and 13, when President Obama with Vice President Biden there drew a red line on nerve gas use in Syria. They violated the red line. We did nothing. He killed over 1,000 people in Damascus using nerve gas, using sarin nerve gas. But it's in their DNA. They may want to use it because it's a weapon that puts absolute fear in the hearts of civilians. And he may try to leverage that to get Zelensky to come to the table. That's my biggest concern.
So the call from Citi is that supply chains are not going to ease. That means that the inflationary narrative that we're living with at the moment is going to be longer lasting than we first thought. You live and breathe this stuff. What do you see?
What we're seeing in supply chains is very simple. It's going to get worse as we move through the second half of this year and into peak season, because you don't initially feel the pinch in the first few weeks of a supply chain shortage. People have inventories. For example, inventories of wheat that are already sitting in the market. They use those inventories up. You really start to feel the pinch when the next harvest hits. That's when the next wave of inflation is going to come through. And the forecasts out there of 7, 8, 9% could easily see 6 or 7% to the upside.
This disruption in the non-energy commodities is the largest we have ever seen. In the case of wheat, it's roughly 25% of global exports. In the metals, it's somewhere around 15%. Just to put this in perspective, the oil supply shock is maybe 1.5% of global supplies. If we repeat that, in wheat, it's 25% of global exports. So the risk here in the agriculture commodities, I think, is very significant.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Despite the jump in bond yields this week, the stock market managed to finish out the week with gains. This comes upon following last week's gains of 6% for the S&P. But bond yields are rising rapidly in anticipation of higher inflation and more aggressive Fed tightening in the months ahead. Energy prices are now holding firm above $100 a barrel, with annual gasoline expenses for the average family running up to $2,000 as the administration's war against the energy industry, along with the war in Ukraine, keep driving prices higher. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to a special edition of the NewsHour. Joining me today for an extensive interview is Jim Bianco from Bianco Research. Jim and I will discuss why inflation will remain high, the looming energy crisis that's ahead of us, and the end of the petrodollar, and why this is going to be one of the more difficult decades to navigate for investors, and much, much more. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Well, this week, the stock market continued its recovery efforts from the March 14th low. And over the past week, the Nasdaq Composite was up almost 2%, the S&P 500 up almost 1.8%, and the Dow Industrials up 0.3%. And of the best performing sectors in the S&P 500, the best performer was energy, up 7.6%, followed by materials up 4.1%, and then finally utilities up 3.5%. Now, healthcare was the only sector that was down this week, down 0.2%. And the primary drivers that saw the momentum this week was mainly just that, momentum, and the Fed speakers and what they did to essentially interest rates this week. Traders followed momentum higher with only one negative day for the S&P 500 on Wednesday, and possibly from the fear of missing out on gains and short covering. It's also likely that bonds continue to be a source for funds and rotation into stocks as rates continued their relentless march higher. In reviewing the ICI's funds flows, it's clear there are very aggressive liquidations happening in bonds compared to stocks. I have data here as of 3/16 that shows weekly outflows between 13 and 21 billion per week coming out of long-term bonds over the past few weeks, compared to 3 to 5 billion out of long-term stock mutual funds for the previous week. And turning to ETFs, that's exchange-traded funds that trade on the stock market, it's night and day between bonds and stocks. Long-term fund inflows were between 12 and 15 billion into stock ETFs for the weeks of March 3rd to March 16th, while there were outflows of 11 billion out each week for the same period from bond ETFs. Inflation is gripping investors, and they're making rotations into stocks with the notion that rates will continue higher, thus hurting those bond market values. And here's why interest rates continue to aggressively move higher this week, even after the Fed just raised rates last week. It's because of Fed speak. This week, there has been a lot of hawkish comments that have been coming out of Fed speakers all week long. As stocks rally, they may feel a little bit more appropriate to speak their mind. The official projections for rates this quarter suggests 7 hikes this year to 1.9%. But remember that those 2 are up from previous quarter's estimates, which were last at 0.9%. Since the Fed announced its quarter point hike last week with only 1 dissent from Bullard, it's clear many of the other members share Bullard's opinion, including Powell. Bullard last week shared that he thinks the Fed funds rate should be above 3% this year. Fed President Kashkari said the Fed may need to get modestly above neutral and even more to contractionary stance if the economy persists in a high-pressure, high-inflation equilibrium. And like I said earlier, Powell reiterated the Fed will be aggressive if necessary, including raising the Fed funds rate by more than 25 basis points at a meeting and moving into a more restrictive stance if needed. His comments were enough to move the two-year Treasury up to 2.19, up 23 basis points by Tuesday when he spoke. Let's keep going, though, because Fed President Mester thinks the Fed funds rate of 2.5% by year-end is appropriate, and Chicago Fed President Evans said 2.75 to 3% by the end of 2023 and 2024. All comments made well above the consensus projections released last week when only one of them dissented on the quarter-point move. The two-year Treasury yield, which is sensitive to the Fed, rose to 2.28% by the end of the week. That's up 32 basis points. And the five-year yield is now inverted above the 10-year yield. We would have a completely flat yield curve if it weren't for the Fed-anchored short-term that just lifted off zero last week. But I see that rapidly changing here with the Fed talking about 50 basis point hikes. The Fed officials may feel they have more room to talk about fighting inflation as we move away from the Nasdaq being down 20%, despite no clear resolution yet between Ukraine and Russia. Oil is also back on the rise again. On that note, up to $112.56 a barrel, up almost $10 on the week. It's scary to think where oil will be when the demand season really picks up this summer. Technically speaking here, the volatility index has dropped considerably this week and is back down to touching 20 from 38 just 2 weeks ago. That's quite amazing given the uncertainty in interest rates, the uncertainty in inflation, the uncertainty in earnings, and an uncertainty over a war in Eastern Europe that is no closer to ending than it did when the VIX was much higher. The word complacency is starting to be thrown around in our investment meetings here at Financial Sense, and smart Financial Sense listeners should stay vigilant and nimble in this environment, as we believe this will be a year of trading and being flexible. All of our purchases for clients in the past month have been oriented on inflation with commodity producers because we don't see inflationary expectations turning around anytime soon, with many structural components to inflation. The bond market gets that. And that's why high yield, corporate bonds, and treasuries have not rallied to the extent that stocks have recently in the past 2 weeks. And that again is because they do not agree with the better outlook on the economy that maybe stocks are interpreting here. Usually when we compare both markets, stocks and bonds, we always side with bond investors. And they're saying right now, rates are not coming down, and neither are they saying economic conditions look to be improving. So while we're participating in this stock advance, we're not overweighting our clients, and we have our finger on the trigger to get defensive when this rally starts to stall. But up next, a special time we have set aside here for Jim Bianco to review his outlook, so please stick around for our special guest this week.
There's a reason Ukraine is nicknamed the breadbasket of Europe. The country produces about 10% of the entire world's wheat, 14% of the world's corn, and half of its sunflower oil.
Ukraine is a big agricultural country. We are 42 million people in the center of Europe, but we feed more than 150 million people worldwide. So this could be a humanitarian crisis that will affect not only Ukraine, but the whole world.
How concerned are you about food prices and some of the possible scenarios that we could be looking at in the coming months?
The short answer is I'm extremely concerned. With this Russia-Ukraine war, I mean, you are basically taking 25% of a lot of major grain groups off the market.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, there's a consensus that's emerging on Wall Street. The Fed will raise interest rates 6 to 7 times. Inflation will begin to recede in the second half of the year, and the Fed can engineer a soft landing. How realistic is that? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program is Jim Bianco. Jim, let's begin with the assumptions that are being made that the Fed is going to get more aggressive. They're going to raise rates 5 to 7 times. What is the risk that we don't get that far? In other words, this cycle stops shorter than what's expected.
So let's talk about why all this talk about the Fed getting aggressive. I would add that the market, the day we're recording, has actually got 9 rate hikes priced in for this year, which includes a 50 basis point hike at the next meeting in May and a 50 basis point hike in the meeting after that in June. So why is the market getting so aggressive? Why is the Fed moving in that direction? The belief is that the Fed's priority, which was growth, to ensure growth as high as possible, has now pivoted to inflation. And the Fed is now, mission one is to bring inflation down. The Fed only has one tool that they could use to bring inflation down, restrict the economy. They can restrict the economy by raising interest rates, pressuring markets. They use the fancy term of tightening financial conditions to get people to spend a little bit less and therefore back off on this big rise in prices. Now, that's a dangerous game that they're playing, because where is the optimal level that we raise rates enough, we scare markets enough that we take them off the boil a little bit, and you think, I think twice about hitting that buy it now button because things are a little dicey, but it stops there and it doesn't descend into a full-blown recession and all of the mess that you have with that. We don't know, and neither does the Fed know how far they have to go. And that's the risk. But let's be clear, their priority has changed. Their priority is now, how do we get prices down? Their priority is not, how do I ensure as high a growth as possible? And if they have to risk growth, I think that they're willing to do that. They think they can do this without going too far. Parlance we use in the market is break something. But I'm not so sure, and I think the market's not so sure, that they might not wind up breaking something before all is said and done.
I want to go back to 2020. We were a short recession, a short bear market.
And for the first time, Jim, we saw the Fed come in and start buying commercial paper, corporate bonds. And what I'm concerned about is, as you're well aware, probably almost what half the investment grade bonds are out there that are triple B. What happens as we're seeing credit spreads widen right now if all of a sudden you start getting large downgrades as the Fed raises and as the economy slows?
You're right. The Fed came in 2020 and was as aggressive as we have ever seen them in terms of they were buying at one point almost 2 years ago to the day we're recording. They were buying $100 billion worth of bonds a day at that point in order to try and stem what was going on in the markets. They were able to get away with that, if I could use that word, because what their actions of 2 years ago never did was produce inflation. So they can have a single focus on growth is in peril because of the lockdowns. Financial markets are plunging, which could create a wealth reverse wealth effect. We need to support both of them to cushion the blow on the U.S. economy. They did. I would suggest that they were, at least in the first quarter of 2020, successful because they also didn't get inflation. But now the problem is inflation. And this is going to be the concern as we move forward from here. Will we? Inflation is a game changer. It really is. And it's going, and it's, I think it's game changing what the Fed is doing. And I think it's going to game change how they're going to react. So if markets wobble a little bit, if the economy struggles a little bit, they're not going to be as quick to respond. The parlance we use in Wall Street is the Fed put. You know, when does the Fed step in and start printing money again to try and save the markets? I think that, you know, to stick with the market parlance, the strike price, the point at which they come in, is going to be much lower than we all think it is right now.
You know, the other thing that you have to take a look at, they just passed a supplemental spending bill, $1.5 trillion. So Congress still hasn't got the message that pushing a lot of money into the economy is inflationary. That doesn't seem to get through.
Not only is that not getting through, but again, on the day we're recording, there is a story out that some congressmen are talking about sending subsidies to poor families to pay for high gas prices. Now, I'm all in favor of getting gas prices down and assisting the poor in helping them through this problem. But if the answer is, here's a check so you can afford $5 or $5.50 gas, then it's permanently going to stay at that level if we're going to make it so we can afford it. We need to figure out a way to get it back to $4 as opposed to let's figure out a way to help everybody permanently pay for $5.50 gas as well. So they're not getting that message either. If you want gas prices down, unfortunately, it's very simple economics. You can either restrict demand, which is what you don't want to do, or you can increase supply, which is sort of kind of what they're trying to do with it. But if you're going to subsidize demand at high prices, then you're going to have permanently high prices. And so that's, again, I understand the sentiment that they're trying to get at, but economically, it's not the best way to go about doing it.
Yeah, because as you mentioned, some kind of supplemental distribution to pay for gas prices, the way to do that, they're proposing a windfall profits tax on the oil companies. And as we know, the last time they did that, that backfired. It didn't work. You had less energy. So it almost becomes reinforcing by not only supplementing it, but then also making it more difficult for the oil companies to produce oil.
Yes. You know, and all of this I might add just as an aside, the other thing that's happening with energy and energy companies, which isn't getting discussed, I don't think nearly as much, is this run-up in oil prices has been very painful for the energy industry. Yes, painful. Now, I know you can point to some wildcatters or some drillers that are making money, but Macron, the president of France, is talking about nationalizing some of the energy companies because they've lost so much money. There's a lot of commodity trading houses that trade in energy cash market, energy traders that might go out of business that are seeking bailouts. The European Energy Association has actually asked for central banks to help assist them in a bailout. So you want to pass a windfall profits tax on an industry that's on the verge of going out of business, because it all comes down to that they hedged themselves at lower prices and prices ran up and they wound up losing money on the process because no one expected this kind of price hike. And you're seeing wild volatility in these markets, especially in the price of crude oil. And it has really not been a successful thing for energy trading firms or even the oil companies themselves. They all have trading arms. They're all losing money on this. So yeah, go ahead and put a windfall profits tax on them. There are no windfall profits, is what you're going to soon find out. Because when a market gets dysfunctional like this, nobody has a plan for here's how I make money when things go awry. And that seems to be what's happening in the energy market right now.
I want to talk about another issue that surfaced, and that is Saudi Arabia trading with China, getting paid in yuan. Let's talk about the implications for the petrodollar, because if India does it, China does it, Russia does it, what happens to the petrodollar?
Yeah, you know, not only is Saudi Arabia trading with China getting paid in yuan, India has already bought some oil from Russia and paid in rubles. And again, a lot of interesting stories regarding this interview. The day we're recording, the Russians have come out and said that the Europeans that get 40% of their natural gas from Russia, Russia said that they'll continue to honor that and give them the 40% of the natural gas that they need, but they want to get paid in rubles now as well too. And then one other thing, Mario Draghi, the prime minister of Italy, former ECB chairman, came out and said that he's inclined to not pay in rubles. I guess Mario wants to pay in Gucci loafers to all the guys. And that's, you know, that way he kills two birds with one stone. But what you're seeing here is a fracturing of the petrodollar system or a fracturing of the reserve currency system. Most international trade is priced in US dollars. It is the reserve currency. Everybody has them. It makes it easier, efficient for world trade to take place by having one benchmark currency that you price it in. Now, the thing about using the US dollar as your reserve currency is Americans, the US economy, benefits greatly from that. They refer to that as the exorbitant privilege, because we, as Americans, we don't have to worry about currency risk when we buy commodities or goods from China or oil, because we pay for it in our currency. And so it isn't that the price has changed because our currency's lost value or increased in value. It's because the price has changed. So it removes a huge friction for the U.S. economy and helps the U.S. economy go better. If the rest of the world is going to walk away from the petrodollar, which is the beginning of it, and start pricing everything in different currencies. And imagine if you're Walmart and you have to now start paying for stuff in every individual country's currency. If you've got a Vietnamese supplier, you got to pay in the Vietnamese dong. You've got to pay in the Indonesian currency. You got to pay in the Malaysian currency, the Philippine currency, the Chinese yuan, the Japanese yen, the South Korean yuan as well. You know, you got to pay in these endless numbers of currencies, whereas today you just pay everything in dollars. It's going to greatly increase the friction of world trade. And if we see this fracturing continue, it is going to reduce world trade. It is going to reduce the friction of globalization. Ultimately, it's going to be a drag, not only on our economy, but on everybody else's economy as well, too. So the question you have to ask, and I can't answer it for you, is, does the rest of the world hate the idea that we have this benefit of having everything priced in dollars so much that they're willing to do harm to the global trade system to get back at the US? Or is it just, these are just for show, and eventually we'll start to realize the best system we have is to have one unified reserve currency? As much as you might hate it, there is no alternative that's at least as good as that. All the other options are worse.
And if we go to this multi-currency system, let's talk about another thing, reverse globalization. So you're hearing Intel's building a factory in Ohio. I know they're building one in Arizona. As more companies come back, we know it's more expensive to produce things. Let's talk about some of the inflationary impacts of reverse globalization, just as globalization helped to bring down cost of labor and the cost of producing goods. What happens when it reverses?
Yeah, when it reverses, I mean, I understand that globalization also produced some pain and heartache in a lot of former manufacturing towns because they could not compete with foreign manufacturers. And at the very margin, it might help. Yes, Intel's going to build a fabrication plant in Columbus, Ohio, and that will help increase manufacturing employment when or if that factory ever becomes reality. As well too. But overall for the economy, it's going to make things more expensive. Now, the argument we're using with that is we need to protect ourselves because what we've learned in the last 2 months, whether it was because of the roar with the Ukraine or the Canadian truckers or anything in between, that your money, your trade is at risk, that a government or a group of people can get together and ban you or restrict you from doing business, all this self-sanctioning we're seeing with Russia as well too. And so to protect yourself from that, if I build this stuff in the United States, I don't have to worry about that. But the problem is the reason you weren't building it in the United States in the first place is it's a lot more expensive to do it here. So it will lead to more, to use a Fed term, persistent inflation as we move forward from here. Now, it might be necessary because the alternative is we keep relying on semiconductors from Taiwan. And Taiwan produces the majority of semiconductors in the world through Taiwan Semiconductor, their giant company, until or unless China invades Taiwan. And then all of a sudden, the world's supply of semiconductors is in peril. So do we want to live that way? Oh, they're cheap. But at any moment, we're going to wake up and see Chinese troops in Taiwan, and that changes everything. Or do we want to protect ourselves by diversifying away? But that's a lot more expensive to do it that way. The point is, we are seeing some kind of reverse globalization.
So taking that a step further, too, it's not just bringing manufacturing back here. But Jim, let's talk about what we found out with this Ukrainian war. Is that Russia is a main exporter of wheat, so is the Ukraine. They're saying that they may not get all their crops in because they got tanks on farms now. And then also key strategic materials. I don't care if it's uranium coming out of Russia, wheat coming out of Russia, or rare earths, copper, and other lithium and other key metals that go with the green economy.
Yeah, that's going to be a real problem as we go forward from here. Let's put some numbers on this. We're all familiar with. The Ukraine produces 10% of the wheat exports of the world, and the area in the Russia around the Ukraine produces another 9%. As a matter of fact, Jim, here's a fun fact that I just recently learned. We all see the Ukrainian flag all over social media, and some people are even flying it, and it's golden on the bottom and blue on the top, and that is supposed to signify a golden wheat field over a clear blue sky. That's how important wheat is to their country. It's literally their national flag. If we don't see spring planting, if we don't see the proper harvesting of winter wheat that needs to be harvested right now, there is credible talk of not just higher food prices in the fall, but a global famine, that they mean that much to it. Add in the energy prices, add in the fertilizer that we get. Over half the world's fertilizer comes from Russia and the Ukraine. As well too, add in some of the rare earths and some of the other commodities that come out of those areas. And you could really see the base prices for manufacturing stuff that we all want and food really continue to move higher from here, unless we get a quick resolution to hostilities. And I'm going to define that as something that will allow the farmers back in the fields, the oil to flow, the commodities, you know, the ships to start docking either in the Ukraine or Russia and loading up on those materials and shipping them to the rest of the world in order to produce the products that and services that we need. Now, I'd like to hope, or I hope there is a resolution to the war quickly, but the hope is not a strategy. That's all we've really got right now is just hope.
I want to bring something that's kind of like an elephant in the room, and that's, you know, we've seen Boris Johnson make a trip to Saudi Arabia asking them to produce more oil. Biden is trying to get him to do it. They're not budging. And one of the things that really strikes me on following the oil market, Jim, is that it's widely believed that Saudi Arabia has a excess capacity of 2 to 2.5 million barrels, that they could go to 12.5. I can say this, just watching statistics, they have never produced 12.5 million. And many times when they have gotten up to 10, they've really kind of cheated. They've taken it from inventory or they've taken Iraqi oil to do that. So at a time you're taking oil off the market with the Ukrainian war, I just don't think they have the spare capacity to do that, which is really more important if you want to talk about bringing energy down. The only country that has really increased energy production over the last decade has been the United States when we got up to be the largest producer at 13 million barrels a day.
Yeah, I agree with you. The Saudis are very secretive, so we don't really know what their capacity is, their maximum capacity, and where they are right now. And there is some discussion as to whether or not, you know, they've got a little spigot that they can open it up and go to 12 million barrels a day. Throw into that the geopolitics of it as well, too. They're not returning. They're literally not returning President Biden's phone call because they're mad at him that he's trying to make a deal with the Iranians for more oil. And that's their enemy that they're fighting in Yemen as well, too. We're also looking to Maduro in Venezuela to try and get more oil. The problem here is a very simple one. Putin's a mean, bad guy. OK, fine. So we're not going to take his 5 million barrels of oil that he exports a day. And we don't seem to be taking it. China would like to take it, but the problem is all the pipelines and stuff from the Siberian oil fields, they go towards the West. They go towards Europe. In order to ship the oil to China, they would have to build a pipeline the equivalent of, I mean, if you look at a map, it's like building a pipeline from Anchorage to Miami. Well, yeah, they'll have that done in 10 years and maybe for $50 billion, but it ain't going to happen right away. So we're looking to Saudi Arabia, Iran, Venezuela to fill the void, when some people like me have asked, why don't we ask like Texas and North Dakota to fill the void? Because at least that's a stable place to find the oil. And all you hear is environmental, environmental and stuff. Well, it's actually the way that they would actually produce the oil in Texas and North Dakota would be a lot more environmentally friendly than the way they're producing the oil in Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. So it is a kind of a real messy situation. And ultimately, I think the oil market is coming to the conclusion that we're not going to be able to find a real fill that void from Russia, which is why, given all the wild volatility because of the trading, the trend is still higher. As we are recording, the price of Brent crude oil, the world benchmark, is back to $122 a barrel. Last week, it was under $100 a barrel. That's how volatile these markets have been. And I still think the trend has reasserted itself higher. And as much as we want to say, oh, we'll get it from the Saudis or the Venezuelans or the Iranians to fill that gap, the oil market's speaking. It's going up in price, saying you're not going to be able to fill that gap. You're going to have a supply shortage.
How much pressure do you think this is going to be? And the day you and I are speaking, a new poll just came out, so Biden's popularity is sinking even further. And I'm just thinking of the fall elections, Jim. If we're at $6 gas nationally or $7 in California, and we're still running with double-digit inflation, what is it going to cause to get him to say, you know what, let's turn on the domestic spigot?
That's a good question, because I think it's important to understand that all of this inflation is showing up. The public, the general public, doesn't necessarily know who Jay Powell is or exactly what the Federal Reserve does. I'm not trying to insult them. They don't need to know that. They just know that prices are up. They are overwhelmingly saying that the number one issue in the country is inflation. It's not racial justice. It's not Russia-Ukraine. It's not immigration. It's not crime. It is inflation. And that's why the president's approval rating is still sinking. Congress's approval rating, Congress's majority Democrat, is still sinking. It's about inflation. And there is intense pressure on the Fed to do something about inflation. And there's intense pressure on Congress to do something about inflation. We already talked about they might subsidize high gas prices. The progressive wing of Congress, the Sanders, the Warrens, the AOCs, are openly talking about price controls, whether it be on shipping or on crude oil or a whole host of beef, hamburger prices, a whole host of other things as well, too. We know economically that all price controls do is produce shortages. So that's not a good one, but it's a sign of desperation is what it is. But you're right. I would think if this gets bad enough that there might that they might just have to push aside the progressive wing and say, look, they're just going to produce oil as cleanly as possible, but we still need this stuff in order to make the country function properly. The problem is if you wait too late and if your goal is to get the price of gas down by the first Tuesday of November, it might not happen by the first Tuesday of November. It might happen in 23, which would be too late for the politicians that are looking at the November election.
So when we take a look and adding all this up, taking a look at oil, as we mentioned, maybe there just isn't the capability of OPEC to produce that. You've got food shortages or possibly famine if this war in the Ukraine doesn't stop. You've got labor markets where you still have a lot of workers that, you know, Jay Powell said he's hoping that workers will start to come back to work. You've got rent. The Wall Street Journal had an article, Jim. Some of the largest apartment REITs are reporting 15 to 16% rent increases year over year. You've got new fiscal spending with this supplemental spending bill. And then you have a massive amount of debt, not just at the corporate level. Consumer debt was up by over $1 trillion last year. And of course, the government's debt itself. So it just seems if you add all those together in the put them in the mixer, I just don't know if this realistic to assume that if the Fed is that we'll be back down to their 2% inflation rate by 2023. I just don't see that happening. Do you?
No. And I also think that Jay Powell doesn't see that happening either. Because I think the significant event of the week we're recording was the prior week, last week for us, was the Fed press conference. Jay Powell spoke and he said in the press conference, let me summarize the opinion of the entire FOMC. And the market's takeaway was, hey, they sound pretty dovish. And markets responded to that. But this week, he spoke at the National Association of Business Economists, NABE conference, and now Powell was speaking on behalf of himself instead of summarizing the committee. And he sounded really hawkish in that speech. So it's fair to say that if you look at this thing the Fed puts out called the dot plot, which is where each individual member of the Fed thinks the funds rate's going to be at the end of 22, 23, 24 in the long term, Powell might be one of the higher dots. So when you go through that litany of all of the problems with inflation, and it is going to stay sticky high, I think I'm guessing a guy that would agree with us is Jay Powell, and he intends on doing something about it, which is what the market is sensing, which is why it's got 50 basis points for the next two meetings and 9 rate hikes. That's 2.25% higher, or the funds rate ends at 2.25%, if you want to think of it in those terms, because we started at zero by the end of the year. And so all of this talk that the Fed might be less inclined to raise rates, I think, is misplaced, because Powell has made it very clear his priority is to deal with this inflation problem, and his priority is to raise rates enough to restrict the economy.
So at what point do you think it starts to impact the economy? In other words, the risk of going into a recession, because, Jim, I'm looking at mortgage rates now that are 4.5%. You know, here in California, homes are going up literally $100,000 a month. Our definition of a millionaire is a homeowner. How long can this continue? Sooner or later, we're going to start to see cracks in the real estate market if we're not seeing that already.
Yeah, you know, I'll give you two incredible statistics for anybody who's watched home prices for a little bit of a while. Redfin, big online real estate site, says that the average list price for a house today is less than a week, and 40% of all homes trade at above their offering price. It's almost to the point now where you can list your house at a dollar and just let all the bidders come in and just bid it up to whatever price the highest bidder wins. You know, that the price you post at your house at is almost irrelevant because you're going to start getting bids within 72 hours. And then you'll just take whichever one is the highest. That this is a completely different housing market than we've ever seen as well. And you're right. The housing market is something that is unusual. Now, it is, I got to be honest with you. I'm at a loss for words to explain the housing market. I'll cite to you a Wall Street Journal story I read yesterday. In the island of Manhattan, the residential market in Manhattan is as strong as it has ever been. Rents, because most people rent in Manhattan, are through the roof. You mentioned some of the REITs are starting to see huge earnings. Home prices, condo prices, co-op prices in Manhattan are going ballistic like they are everywhere else. Midtown Manhattan is home to 11% of all office real estate in the country. Midtown Manhattan is in a death spiral because no one's returning back to the office because of the work from home, remote work thing. Tremendous amounts. They've got at least a 40-year high in office vacancies, and it's only going up. Everybody's trying to get rid of real estate. And it's been described that what might happen to big office towers, office real estate like Midtown Manhattan, might be akin to like a Rust Belt city in the early 70s, as it was realizing that its manufacturing base was going away. Well, New York City's office rental space might be going away because of remote work at the same time that the residential business in New York City has never been better. It seems like what the American public is saying, or at least what Manhattanites are saying, is we love living in Manhattan. We just don't want to work in Midtown anymore. I don't know, quite understand how those two things can be true at the same time. But that's kind of where we are in the entire housing market. So, yeah, I agree with you. It shouldn't last, but I'm surprised it's even gotten to this point to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, we have a situation here. I have an employee that's trying to get into a condo. There's a new condo complex. And you put your name on the list, Jim, and then when the units become available, what they do is, if you're on the list, you just don't get it at the asking price. What they do is, well, we've got one unit coming up. There's four of you on the list. We'll take the highest bidder. So in this case, the condo started at $750. The bids went for $850.
Yeah. You know, and be lucky that you're not trying to buy a used car, because it's the same thing that's going on in the used car market too, as well. So this is an unusual market. In that what we're seeing, we've never seen markets like this, because like I said, you know, to go back to my example, you could both have on the same 12-mile island, a booming real estate market and a collapsing office market at the same time. So this is unusual that we've seen what's going on with all of these markets right now.
So if you were looking longer term, I think this is going to be an inflationary decade for the number of reasons we talked about: energy, food, labor, rent, fiscal spending, and corporate debt. So how does the Fed navigate this? Because if they do put us into a recession and they go too far, how in the hell are they going to bring us out?
Yeah, well, that's going to be a real problem. The one other thing I would throw into that mix about, yes, I agree it's going to be an inflation decade, is let's also remember that the big economic event was 2 years ago. We sent everybody home for a year. In some cases, for 2 years. That changed everything. The entire economy was structured around the idea that 150 million of us went to work every day. We woke 9 to 5, 5 days a week. You know, you went to a place called an office or a factory or a shop, and you performed your tasks there. So whether it was the transportation systems, it was services, it was products we bought, were all centered around that idea that we went to this office. Now we don't. We don't go there nearly as much. Some of us are hybrid, some of us are at home, and we seem to be moving in that. Our entire consumption basket is changing. The services I need, the products I require have changed because I'm at home more often now than I've been in the past. And what that requires is a significant amount of investment. Companies need to start making the stuff we now require post-pandemic. supply chains need to be reoriented to the stuff we make, we want post-pandemic. And we need to make less and divert away from the stuff that we don't want post-pandemic. But for the moment, we don't seem to be doing that. For the moment, we keep insisting that everything will return back to 2019. And it's not. I'm not suggesting a dystopian future. It's just a different future. And that also is going to lead to more frictions and more problems that we're not going to get beyond this. If the Fed wants to put us into a recession to try and cool prices, how are we going to get the investment to restructure to a new remote work, work from home economy? It's going to be slower is what it's going to be at that point. So add all this up. We are in a higher inflationary environment and we are going to be in that. We're not going to be in the 70s. At least I hope we're not going to be in the 70s. Short of things like war and supply constrictions, which would spike inflation prices, what we're seeing now, assuming that that is not the constant state in the next decade, and God, I hope it's not, we will just be in an elevated inflation environment, which means higher interest rates, which means lower multiples, which means a more aggressive Fed as we move forward from here, which means investments like commodities or inflation beneficiaries, gold will take top tier as opposed to middle or lower tier like they were in the past. So a lot of things can change as we move forward from here.
So how does one navigate this from an investment perspective? For example, if you want to be conservative, thinking that, you know, the market could be subject for further downside, you go into cash. So if I go into cash, Jim, I can go into a one-year treasury bill at maybe 1.3% when we've got 8 to 10% inflation. So even staying in cash, you're losing money.
There is no good option right now. So if you are in equities, and just to keep a simple example, and you say, I don't like the outlook for equities. Cash, you're exactly right. I could go into something that's yielding 1% and 9% inflation world and lose 8% real. No way. Bonds, maybe I should go into bonds. The problem with bonds is if you look at the bear market that's unfolding in bonds, higher interest rates, the month of March is on track to be one of the worst months maybe ever, or at least in the last 40 years, to be a bond investor. The losses that are being piled up in the bond market for the bond market are staggering. So the Bloomberg Global Aggregate Index is down 6% for the first quarter. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot if you're a stock investor, or if you're a tech stock investor, that sounds like Tuesday. But if you're a bond investor, to lose 6% in the global aggregate index in a quarter is huge. That is a tremendous loss to have happen. So I don't like stocks. I'm not going to go into cash. I don't like stocks. Am I going to buy into the worst bond market in 40 years? How about commodities? Maybe I should play commodities. Man, there's volatile as cryptocurrencies right now, the way that they are flying around all over the place. They might be a good long-term play, but you've got to really adjust. I mean, as I pointed out with crude oil, no one's getting exercise that it's only up 25% in six trading days. I mean, Bitcoin doesn't do that right now. So if you're going to invest in energy or commodities, you're going to have to be prepared for, I bought it 2 days ago and I just lost 20% of my money. Yeah, that's what happens. Be patient. It will come back maybe in the next 3 days or maybe in the next 4 months. But you have to, so that's very difficult as well too. Cryptocurrencies, a good idea, but they're not really ready to be a, you know, something that you would divert a major part of your assets to. Yeah, 1 or 2 or 3% would be fine, but you're not ready to put 30 or 40 or 50% in a lot of that stuff. So there's really no good options because the good options have extreme volatility. The safe options are like bonds are not as safe as we think they are because I think the bond market's trying to readjust to an inflation world. You know, people have asked me the question, what do you think is going to happen in the bond market if we have a 40-year high in inflation? Well, we've on a total return basis, we've got the worst markets in 40 years. So there you go. And that's how I think the bond market is still trying to adjust to it. And I don't want to buy into a market that's having the worst markets in 40 years right now. Yeah, I might, on an absolute basis, lose less money in bonds than I would maybe in stocks. But on an absolute basis, bond market's just not a good place to be.
So let's talk about, you know, we talked about the changes that have come about with COVID, the pandemic, the supply chain issues. As you mentioned, in Manhattan, you could have a strong residential market, a weak, collapsing commercial market. I want to talk about something that has ruled this industry for almost half a century, and that's the 60-40 asset allocation mix, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And Jim, that worked for four decades. So when we had the financial crisis, stocks lost close to 60%. But if you were in the bond market, your bonds were going up and helped offset those losses. That's not working now and may not work going forward.
The key driver of the 60-40 portfolio was the lack of inflation. Because when you had no inflation, this price of bonds and the price of stocks moved opposite each other. So they provided a natural hedge. You own 60% stocks, the market went up, you participated. When the market got wobbly and fell, your bond portfolio rallied to cushion you on the downside. And it worked fantastic. But when you get into an inflationary environment, like we've seen in the last year, like we saw in the 70s, bonds and stocks prices don't move opposite, they move together. They go up together, they go down together. So your 60-40 portfolio becomes a 100-0 portfolio. Either both legs are going up, in which case you say, well, why do I even own bonds if both of them are going to go up? I'd rather own stocks to go up more. Or both go down together, and then you say nothing is protecting me on the downside because they're both losing money. That's what happened in the 70s. That's what's happening now. And it's largely because of inflation. So the 60-40 portfolio might be a casualty of a high inflation environment. When we ever go back to a low disinflation environment again, it will return as a viable alternative. But right now, it's not.
So given what we see coming, that inflation is going to be with us for a lot longer, the very high risk of what the Fed overshoots, as an investor, how do you navigate this? What would you be doing?
This is the single hardest market that I've seen in a long time to navigate. What I'm doing is I am playing in the space that would benefit from inflation, but at much lower percentages than I normally would. So I might be, in normal times, I might have said, I think inflation's going up. I want to have 50% of my portfolio oriented towards metals and energy and basic materials and industrials and maybe some commodities and stuff. Maybe half my portfolio would be that way. It's 15% right now because I'm getting the same bang with the 15% that I would if I had 50% of it in normal times because of all of the volatility. Bonds, it's a tough one to be, like I said, it's tough to be long bonds. The other option that you have, I think, is unfortunately, it's a managed loss situation. Now we're talking about asset classes here. So, you know, I got to manage losses in the stock market. I got to manage losses in the bond market as well. Obviously, there's always going to be special circumstances, you know, whether it's a real estate deal or a tech deal or some other kind of limited partnership or something else that might be uncorrelated to the larger investment markets or larger economy. Those are always viable options for people, but those don't always present themselves to each other as well too. But when people say, what do I do in this environment? What they're asking, I think, is stocks, bonds, cash, alternative. One of those is going to go up 20%. Which one is it? And I would probably say in the alternative space, it might be commodities. But like I said before, it isn't going to come without at least one or two thrill rides along the way. So it's not going to be something where buy it and forget about it and we'll see where it is in a year. It's going to be a thrill ride. And that might not be what people want to hear, but unfortunately, that's what happens when you have a regime shift towards inflation. A lot of assumptions and a lot of the ways we become uncomfortable with the way markets work are changing.
Well, as we mentioned, and we started this conversation just looking at oil, I mean, we were at 130, we got all the way down to 90. And here on the day you and I are speaking, we're, you know, what is it, 122 on Brent?
Yes. You know, about 115 on WTI. And yeah, I mean, That's not normal. That is not. I can remember, but I'm old enough to remember like 3 months ago when the oil moved 70 cents in a day and that was a big deal. Now it moves $10 in a day and nobody notices. You know, so that's how much these markets have changed and how fast they've changed.
Well, listen, Jim, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you do some of the best research that I've ever seen on Wall Street. So how could they follow you?
Well, I thank you very much for that compliment. Simple way is social media. I'm active on social media. Twitter is my main driver at Bianco Research. You could search Jim Bianco on LinkedIn or my website, biancoresearch.com.
All right. As always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks for updating our listeners and all the best to you, sir.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.